Talk given Sunday, 9th August 1981. In the modern world, where man has achieved so much control over the forces of nature and thinks himself master of everything, many people ask the question, why should one live the religious life at all? Here we have all the means of production and the sufficient knowledge to make life perfectly comfortable and happy. Now the fact is that some people in the world are comfortable, but probably quite two-thirds of the world is very uncomfortable. It is hungry, it suffers from diseases, it suffers from all sorts of political and other upheavals, and people are really not comfortable. In fact, they are in a state of considerable misery. One has only to travel to continents like Africa and Asia to see this. So the question is asked mainly by people in Europe and America. And it is worthwhile inquiring into this and finding out why some people in Europe and America, quite a large number in fact, do take to religion, turn to religion with the intention of living the religious life, not merely to satisfy their intellectual curiosity regarding what the religions teach or how they arose, how they have flourished, and so on and so on. Now, if we ask this question, we must first recognize that in the so-called advanced countries of the world, particularly the economically advanced countries of the world, and Germany is a very good modern example of it, West Germany, people are well off, very well off. And I believe the Scandinavian countries too, this applies to the Scandinavian countries too. They are extremely well off, but they are not happy. They are not satisfied. They are bored. They don't know what to do with themselves. They inquire, what is the meaning of life? What is the purpose of our existence here? It is true that we have plenty of food, plenty of amusements, and all the good things of the world in the purely material and worldly sense, but something in them is hungry, something very, very dissatisfied. And we can look into the reasons for this a little later on. But we can see that so many people turn to religion because they are unhappy, they are suffering. Suffering within themselves because they can't make life a happy life in the true sense of the word happy. They have pleasure, yes, plenty of pleasure available. But the true happiness, that inner quiet, peace of mind, and a sense of purpose and worthwhileness in living on this planet is absent. So they have tried out all sorts of worldly means for making themselves happy and found that all of them fail. So they feel, let's try religion. Like trying another drug or whatever it is, you see, trying another sort of amusement. They turn to religion for that reason, because there is so much suffering. And they think that out of religious teachings, they might get some comfort for their suffering. There is none of us have any doubts about the suffering in the world. Then there are others who are afraid. they want to find security in the hereafter. They believe in a hereafter, and what they have gathered in their childhood, if they have had any sort of conventional religious teachings, is that if you live the good life, you will go to heaven and you'll be happy ever afterwards. If you're a bad lad, well, you'll go to the other place and be warm ever afterwards. Over warm, in fact. So now they are afraid of that. And religions, particularly like Buddhism and Roman Catholicism, they have presented the most ghastly pictures of the torments of hell. They have excelled all the other religions in presenting these pictures of the torments in hell. So, although they may superficially tend to disbelieve all that and look down their noses upon it all, inside themselves there is a fear, and a very real fear, and a deep fear. The result is that this fear, instead of being the right sort of stimulus to make them turn to true religious living, produces inner conflicts and constant misinterpretations and misunderstandings regarding the religious teachings of the world, and particularly regarding the meaning of living religiously. So this has to be borne in mind. These are two very powerful influences. Then again, there are other influences which incline people to take to religion. There is the fact that one can obtain a living through entering religion. You know the humorous saying, the fool of the family goes into the church. There are sayings like that. The church, at least in past years, did offer a certain degree of material security to the priest. Nowadays, it doesn't offer the same sort of material security. But one can see this kind of material security which was achieved by the upper rungs of the hierarchy. If one reads, say, English history alone, in the last century there was a bishop. Unfortunately, I've forgotten of which place, the bishop of some place or other, but I read it in my history years ago, over 30 years ago, in fact, that he his income was 40,000 pounds a year. And an income of 40,000 pounds a year in the last century was, one may almost say, a stupendous income. So there was that sort of inducement. Added to that was the fact that the clergy have always been looked up to and regarded with respect, and so on. So one had material gains, one received honors, and this applies not only to Christian clergy, but the Buddhist monks or the Hindu swamis and so forth. They too had a comfortable time by being swamis. It was a way of escaping one's proper duties as a citizen, as a member of a family, and so on. It is the way of the escapologist very often, and not a genuine urge, an absolutely honest, genuine urge to live the religious life, which inclines some of them, in fact a great many of them, to take to religion as such. Then, we have also to consider that there is spiritual ambition which moves many people to take to religion professionally. professionally in the commoner garden sense of entering the monkhood or entering monkhood or becoming a member of the church and so forth. The spiritual ambition to experience all kinds of wonderful supernormal, supernatural experiences. Nowadays they call it having a trip to higher planes and so forth. They little realize that more often than not, these so-called trips to higher planes are actually just derangements of the mind, illnesses of the brain, especially as and when they take to drugs for this purpose. Some take to drugs as an experiment to find out what there is in it. But does anyone make the experiment of jumping over Beachy Head in order to find out what it is like to have a trip down to the sea rather swiftly? No one thinks of that. But people do take the drugs and they get all kinds of impressions which they think are genuine spiritual experiences. They are nothing of the sort. So one must put all that absolutely aside. The late Professor Zainer, a very brilliant scholar, really a brilliant scholar, but rather short in vision as regards what discipline he should follow. He was a Catholic, one who was converted to Catholicism, and a very genuine devotee, until in his later years he became he had the chair for Eastern religions, the Spalding Chair for Eastern Religions in Oxford University. I met Professor Zainer. I know he was a very brilliant intellect and very reliable as a scholar up to a certain point, but not beyond that point. Now, there came there was an occasion when he began to take drugs to experiment and find out for himself what was the nature of the deep states of consciousness which the mystic experiences, the true religia experiences, those who have talked about the unio mystica through the ages, and those who have talked of realizing samadhi and union with God and such things, you see. He wanted to find it out by taking drugs, because he was told by so many who had taken them that they had marvelous inner experiences, but of which they could not give any rational, adequate description. So he took drugs himself. Shortly afterwards, he died. And he did not produce anything worthwhile reading after his drug experiments. I'm just mentioning one example. There are so many examples of that sort of thing. So it is this absurd spiritual ambition to experience divine states or supernatural, superhuman states and so forth in inner consciousness, which drives some people to take to religion. All this we must, if we are really honest and serious about living the religious life, put right aside. There are many other influences which move people to take to religion, but they take to it superficially and in the wrong way. Now, we might inquire, what is the proper approach to religious living? Let us realize quite clearly, first and foremost, that the word religion means, from its Latin derivation, religare, it means to be related back to transcendence, the source from which we come. Religare, to bind back again. This was the view held by Servius, Lactantius, and St. Augustine when they defined the word religion, which is an extremely good way of understanding religion and the purpose of religion. And we have in yoga, in Patanjali's aphorisms on yoga, the teaching, and we have it also in all the other religious and philosophical teachings of India, that the living of the religious life is for the purpose of being restored into complete and perfect relationship with the totality, with God, with Brahman, use whatever word you like. That is the real purpose and function of religious living, that the individual shall be restored to complete relationship. Now, if that is the reason why these religious teachings were given and the art of living the religious life was expounded, the obvious conclusion is that we, as we are through the ages, not merely the centuries and millennia, but through the ages, have always suffered from the illusion that each one of us is a separate, isolated being, not related or only partially related to everyone else in the world, to all objects in the universe, and to the totality, whatever that totality may be. We suffer from that extraordinary limitation, that we are isolatively and separatively self-conscious. Because of that, we inevitably are in a state of conflict with our neighbor, with circumstance, with so much that makes up our life as human beings. So now, the purpose of religious living can be put in that form. The restoration to complete and perfect relationship with the totality. We are integral part and parcel of the whole universe, not only of the human race. An integral part and parcel, which means that the entire universe affects us all the time, and we, each one of us individually in our turn, affects the universe. It's a tremendous responsibility. We may say, oh, how can I, poor little miserable sinner, a small worm wriggling on the planet Earth, affect the universe? I'm not as great as that. No, I'm as little as that. That is why I can affect the universe. Now, this sounds very funny, but it is a scientifically known fact now that there is nothing in the universe of any size whatsoever, be it an atom or a whole galaxy, if you like, which does not continuously affect the totality. And this is the marvel of our individual existence, if we confine ourselves to just the human race as such, that we are affecting the universe all the time by what we are, and particularly by the manner in which we are conscious of ourselves and the world in which we live. The manner in which we are conscious. So we'll see that the whole task of religious living boils down to a complete transformation, a complete transformation of our mode of awareness of the totality and of ourselves and of our relationship within that totality, to that totality, within that totality. You will notice that as I talk, I have no option but to talk in dualistic terms. I talk of ourselves, our individual selves, and the totality, as if they were two things. But they are not. We are completely contained within the totality. But because of our fundamental limitation of isolative self-consciousness, it is impossible to get away from talking in terms of duality. Because all our thought, all our speech is in terms of thou and I, or oneself and the other. The self and the not self. And you will notice that even in the most advanced and abstruse philosophies along these lines in India, and they certainly touch the heights, reach the heights and touch the depths in this respect, they too have not been able to escape talking in terms of duality, the self and the not self. But as long as we preserve that duality, even in ordinary thought, we are always going to be in a state of conflict. So now the question arises, what then are the essentials of true religious living? And this is a tremendous question. It is the most important question that any person claiming to be a human being can ask of himself and of the world in which he lives. What constitutes truly religious living? The common mistake is to think of religious living as something apart from, different from, and often as opposed to secular living. Now this is a hopeless way to set about it. We live in the world. We shall be living in the world all our life. Whether we are saints or sinners, we are always in the world. Now the difference comes here. We have to live in the world, but not be of the world. That is to say, not be like, remain as a person who is isolatively self-conscious and therefore in conflict with the world and within himself too. You see, this is the important point, to be free of that isolative self-consciousness. And immediately the question arises, well, how do I set about it? First of all, we must realize that consciousness is something that we don't know. We know our mental states. We know in our ordinary experience that when through the operation of our senses, of sight, hearing, touch, and so forth, we are aware of any of the multitudinous objects and persons composing the world in which we live, composing the universe, we think of it all in separative terms. We must become aware of that. Now that is a thought only. That is not being conscious of the unitary wholeness. This is where many people find a very great difficulty. They study the religions, they attempt certain set disciplines, and find that there is no kind of transformation of their mode of awareness of existence. The test comes here. When circumstance becomes sufficiently provocative or sufficiently difficult, they act in a manner which is not in line with their intellectual assent to the religious teachings. They act like the subhuman that they are. That is to say, they act only in terms of their own interest. They act through fear, through ignorance, through violence, and so forth. This is the important thing. Life tests us all the time. And we discover that when the stimulus is sufficiently provocative, we have fallen into the pit of violence, fear, hate, greed, illusion and delusion. That is what happens actually with us, you see. So now, when we consider this business of the living of a religious life, we must always keep in mind in terms of, at least to begin with, a thought in the brain, that our task is one of completely transforming our mode of awareness of existence. And that mode of awareness, that inner depth of consciousness, is something which we don't know with the brain. And we never can know with the brain as long as we live. So you will say, well then, if I don't know that, how can I have any sort of compass to guide me, have any direction? The compass does not lie in one's inner consciousness. It does not lie in any knowledge which the brain acquires in terms of thoughts and ideas, teachings and practices and so on. It does not lie there. It lies in the actual living of the daily life in terms of a straightforward, simple, honest, pure morality. Now, what the world's fundamental trouble today is that it has its moral backbone is broken. That is the fundamental trouble in the world today. People cannot regard themselves and their lives and see the world in terms of a living whole and the implications of living. Of unitary wholeness. They can't do that at all. They do that, they live only in terms of reaction. Something happens, a law is passed, the economic situation is thus, this country has decided to make the neutron bomb, and therefore we react in terms of fear and hate and compensatory violence. We must have 2 neutron bombs, or something more powerful than that. Why? For our security, for our safety. We don't see that if anything like the control over the powers of nature, which we have now realized, were to get out of hand, there is no meaning at all to the word our security. Oppressor and oppressed, destroyer and destroyed will all be wiped out. You know how, for example, with the First World War, poison gas, chlorine mainly, was used. And of course, what was that other gas? Mustard gas, as it was called. I remember in Cambridge, Professor Fenton, who was a marvelous lecturer in chemistry, when he was taking, I was taking a course in organic chemistry under him, and he described how mustard gas was made, you see. And he didn't say what it was. It's an organic compound. Organic means that it has carbon atoms in it. The chemistry of the carbon compounds is called organic chemistry. All the rest is called inorganic chemistry. And he worked out the equations and showed the procedure, and then with rather a sad, wry smile, he said, "And this is mustard gas." You see, something which destroys not only the enemy, but also oneself. Because if there's a change of direction of the wind, it comes back upon you like a boomerang. And nuclear power is like that par excellence. Mustard gas is just not in it at all. comparably with nuclear power. So you see, we react in the wrong way to the stimulus from outside, simply because our moral backbone is broken. If we regain our morality, we shall live in terms of truthfulness, harmlessness above all, harmlessness, and therefore we can live compassionately and sensibly and make life beautiful. But the individual has to himself live the good life constantly, uncompromisingly, unconditionally, and unreservedly. This is a titanic task. What we are called upon by life, by God, if you like, to do, is something which is beyond our capacity at the moment. But the extraordinary part of our human existence is just this, that there is that dormant within us which can rise to the supreme heights, fly over Everest, if you like. You see, to put it in a metaphorical terms, we can do that. We can rise to that, because when the psyche is quiet, when oneself psychophysically is very quiet and still and observant, out of the innermost depths of consciousness, this inner power which we don't know, there comes an energy which enables the concrete part of our mind, namely the brain and our body, to act in the right way. And we shall see what is the right thing to do. We shall know it. You know how it is said that we are endowed with a conscience. We do know what is right, we do know what is wrong. Our feeling nature, in harmony with our thinking side, with that is to say the intellectual and the not so much emotional as something more than emotional, the feeling nature, are in real harmony, then conscience works perfectly. This is very important. So, it is necessary to have the right moral basis. And the right moral basis is very simple. We all know about it. To be truthful, loving, constructive, and all the rest of it. To abstain from all evil. It is difficult to fulfill because the provocation offered us by the world, by fate, by circumstance, by the events that take place, is so very strong that we tend to give up. Now the thing is not to struggle, not to fight against what comes at us, which we recognize is evil or wrong. This is one of the unfortunate aspects of the conventional religious teachings of the world, where it is said, overcome evil, fight the good fight. Think of it, fight the good fight. Fighting as such in any shape or form is destructive activity. That is fighting. It is not an activity which relates us harmoniously with our world. We are fighting against a part of the world. You see, this is very difficult to see. What we have to do, we know, for example, the saying, love heals all things. Love heals all things. How can you have love except through real understanding? How can you have real understanding except through the perfect and right use of the senses? Look, listen, and see clearly the fact as it is. In seeing the fact as it is, in its fullness and perfection and in its purity, then one's own psyche becomes pure. This is something the world hasn't tried yet. And it hasn't been taught. It is getting taught gradually now, in this century. It has never been put in those terms before. So we have to learn to be observant. Observant not only of what is outside us, but observant of what comes from within us. Our reactions to every single stimulus which comes towards us, which is received through the senses and interpreted by the brain. And in that kind of observation, we'll become aware of the conditioning of the brain and all our own natural mental defects. So coupled with the healing of the mental defects, what in Buddhism, for instance, has been called the defilements of the mind, correcting that, and at the same time releasing a strong moral backbone throughout the psychophysical organism, we lay the foundation of this restoration to the unity within the unity of the universe. And this is perhaps the supreme reason. There are other reasons too, but this is perhaps the supreme reason why one should live the religious life, bearing in mind that it doesn't mean just going to church on Sundays and swindling your neighbor the remaining days and so forth. You see, one has to live religiously in one's heart, with all one's heart and soul and body, all through every day. So if you're frightened of the difficulty of the task, don't try to enter the religious life. But if you feel that this is the thing that really is worthwhile and human in the supreme sense of the word human, then certainly go for it. And the good God will give you all the strength and power that you need, all the comfort. Comfort means nothing sentimental and slushy. It means com fortis, with strength.